I have lacked much vital things, and the ache has spurred me to intense living. But isn't reality the rousing shock we all need? And do we not lose ourselves in pretense if the truth and tragedy of inequality is not accepted? If we could be equal, what would happen to reverence and compassion? Now, what's the problem here? What's the problem with inequality? What's the problem as a Christian? How do you face that?
What's the problem, inequality?
Yes, I mean, how can you say that inequality is something that you feel is really important? What are you really, you know, really knocking down then?
Homogenization.
Pardon me?
The homogenization.
Well, they're knocking the homogenization, but from a virtuous point of view. I mean, what do we all feel as Christians? Don't we feel everybody should have the same opportunity we've had? Mm-hmm. What does she say here? Read that. Somebody read that line. I want you to realize that she's saying something, and she's addressing you just as Dante says, a poet addresses our condition, and a writer addresses our condition. She's addressing our condition here. Somebody read out loud the second sentence on page 58 in that second paragraph.
At once I feel heartless, though I might wound or dishonor someone who I had left behind.
All right. You feel heartless because you might wound or dishonor someone who had less than you have had. Less from the point of view of givens in terms of your own person, and also in terms of environment, family, what have you. You know, all these things. And she says, this is terrible to advocate inequality when really what we're talking about all the time in present-day society and in Christian thinking is equality. Everybody should have the same chance. Don't let anybody be put down. But then what does she say? What's the next, how does she sort of offset this? Somebody else, what's the next one? The next two, three sentences there. What does she talk about when she talks about what makes for intense living? What is it that, what does it for you?
The ache.
The ache has spurred me to intense living. And she said that what I've lacked myself, she said, you know, I haven't had everything either, but she said the thing that worries me about inequality is that somebody else is going to be, you know, considered is going to have even less than I had, and so I feel heartless if I advocate this. But then she says, the ache of this sort of thing, of my own lack, has spurred me to intense living, and reality is the rousing shock we all need. And if we're going to protect everybody and say we're all equal, nobody's ever going to be roused into being something different from what they are. Because we're going to say, we're going to play God for them and say, you know, I'm going to supply you with everything so you don't have to feel bad. I can struggle because I, of course, really I'm a bigger, better person than you are. And I'm going to take you on and take care of you. You know, it's a demeaning thing that we do in this equality thing if we don't think it through. It's so easy to talk about equality and then realize what we're doing is making just a flat kind of a society with nobody willing to imperil themselves, nobody willing to carry the values, nobody willing to suffer for their differences. And you assume that other people are less than you are. I have it, but of course you don't, and I can't bear to have you suffer. Well, I mean, suffering is part of human beings. And I know that that is a really difficult thing for me to take. I want to protect everybody, you know. And I'm just a good old mother figure, you know, and I'm going to just, you know, I'll straighten you out. Ask me. I'll help you, you know. And this is really bad. When I see nature's inherent inequality, I melt and want to be tender. This is page 59. If one is going to be truthful, one has to be very tender. To respect difference, to try to understand difference, is the only way. The imagination must be stretched to its widest. Every wince of self-knowledge accepted. All this, of course, but never accept the utter unreality of wishing for equality. It would mean that individuality went, goals vanished, and you sank in the static. I cannot see it as a fact, but I hear it as the cry of unlived pride. Who would we be equal to whom? Who would be equal to whom? Do we all go as low as we can to prove we are above no one? Must all the gifts of those greater than we disappear from the world? No triumphs of accomplishment? No drive to discover the rare in ourselves and others? Never to be bemused by beauties we lack? No sudden insight of what might be? No respect or loyalty or humility stirred by what you had not known was possible? But these are our ennobling moments. It is at these times we outgrow ourselves. And when we try to protect ourselves and protect all those around us from any kind of, scratching on the blackboard feeling, that sandstone effect of being sandpaper effect, you right away feel that you've protected and eased people out of their very quality of humanity. The fact that they really are imago Dei, they were made in the image of God. And really, you know, Jesus does not give you that kind of feeling himself. He really lays it on the line for people to respond individually, independently. And yet we always, feel like we know better than he did. I wanted to read a part here. Do you remember the part where she talks about this wonderful charwoman that she sees on the street? It's such a beautiful, beautiful example of her being a human being herself, and her always being aware of who she was and that other people are, you know, are just as exciting and just as valid individuals as she is. On page 123, after a time of trouble, I found a likable flat which was to be my home. I had had a long need of one, so it was also my dear shelter. My daughter and I moved in one evening with two suitcases, two beds, three pots of bulbs, a kettle, and tea things. We lit a brilliant fire in the seemly little grate with the dry slats the builder had left after making a big opening between the two public rooms. I lay in the firelight peacefully listening to the pigeons on the roof. To me, pigeons say, "Too true, dear love, too true." I listened, looking out on the trees beyond both windows, and I was free and happy. The flat had been repainted 2 months before, but London dust sticks, and the flat must be scrubbed. It was already so precious to me that its surface was almost my skin. A charwoman had been promised, and when next morning the bell of my flat pealed out, I opened the door, and there stood the most battered little figure I'd ever seen. Only two yellow teeth, and hair almost burned away from a lifetime of curling tongs. I thought I could not invite her in. Not into my dear, dear flat. But of course I did, though feeling apologetic to the flat. At the end of an hour's scrubbing, she did some act of discrimination, of taste, I've forgotten what, and I exclaimed with pleasure and praised her rightness. She stopped scrubbing, drew herself to the full height of her weary little body, and said slowly and graciously, "Our family, has always been different. I bowed my acknowledgement. She bowed her acceptance of my tribute, and the scrubbing went on. Wonderful, wonderful little, just a, that was many years ago, but only last year, I passed a supermarket and saw coming out a slut of a woman who was fat, unwashed, unkempt in hair and dress, with a large three-cornered tear in her overall. She looked large-hearted and vital, and as our eyes met, something passed between us. We liked each other. She straightened up, placed one hand with fingers spread wide over the tear. Then as we passed, we smiled seriously and bowed with equal dignity. We know who we are, even though we lack the precise name for it. Those are two beautiful little descriptions in just the, you know, almost capsule-like form. I just think they're wonderful. I did want to ask you to any part that you particularly like very much of this in this book, because I know that there are a lot of them, a lot of lines that just will stay with you. I'm just going to read a couple things that come on the Easter week, and then I'm going to just ask if any of you think of anything that you would like to just share with the rest of us. Easter Day. I am in that rare frame of mind when everything seems simple, when I have no doubt that the aim and solution of life is the acceptance of God. This is page 107. It is impossible and imperative and clear. To open to such unimaginable greatness affrights my smallness. I do not know what I seek, cannot know, but I am where the mystery is the certainty. My long life has hardly given me time, I cannot say to understand, but to be able to imagine that God speaks to me, says simply, I keep calling to you, and you do not come. And I answer quite naturally, I couldn't, until I knew there was nowhere else to go. Remember an instance in the life of Jesus and the disciples that exactly parallel with that, right? Yes. Go ahead.
No, I was just thinking out loud.
Well, perfectly right to think out loud. You don't always have to think inside, you know. Oh, you remember when Jesus asks his disciples, will ye also go away? And Peter says, whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. I mean, what is this but a, you know, this is just, she's living through exactly what Peter lived through. I mean, we're all in the same kind of contemporaneity with the Lord. And the great thing is that it can hit you sometimes a lot more abruptly if somebody speaks in this form than if we get it in the same old devotional style that we can go to sleep on from the New Testament. Not that we should, but we do. Perhaps our no to God is our sacred care. If our otherness matters primarily, if we must fill our human role, represent the sacred tension, and say at the utmost point of our endurance and our yearning, you are too different, you ask the impossible, even at the cost of foregoing you altogether, it is our humanity that forces us to deny you. See, this is speaking to God. It was not only pride that made Lucifer oppose you, we too claim our right to a Luciferian no. It has to be. Then God might answer, of course that is your duty. If I had commanded anything less than the impossible, would you have recognized me as God? There being but one answer to that, you remain silent. And God adds, this is what creation is, the might and marvel of forever creating out of opposition. Your blindness is almost strong enough to defeat me. But if the struggle were less, would we belong together? Neat? Really? Really wonderful. And then she says, do I know what I mean? Well, what this is all about. Logic and rightness generally lie too deep to see. Chance can seem a near miracle, or the irony of life can show me how naturally I blunder, or how fortunate I am. Behind everything, my conviction of meaning as well as mystery remains unchanged. What do I mean by this new sense of simplicity? Of it seeming clear that Christ was God and man, and that he symbolized the oneness in each of us. If oneness is what we seek, that we may have roots to nourish us, at the same time knowing there is a division in that oneness, then where am I? Is not Job's acceptance of what was unfair because God was God? Is it that humanity has reached a place, perhaps a new place? How to say it? Some words are too literal, while others are so big that they sweep me into the air like balloons. I must stop generalizing. I in my ignorance, would find satisfaction and relief in saying inside myself, at the dim, dumb point, which is the best I can manage, there I feel impelled to say to God, God and man have begun to seem like fellow creators. And then she goes on and talks about her, you know, her feeling about this. Where does this lead her if she starts talking like this? You know, where's my thought going to lead me? I'm going to really get messed up. And it's important that you understand that this is not a catechism, you know. This isn't a brief for the truth of Scripture or Christianity. I think this is just one woman's testament of her life in her 80s. How can anyone conceive of a godless world without foreseeing our disintegration? And then she says, in the next paragraph on page 114, if we are the meeting place of God and Satan, and so it can feel, then without God we could become Satan. Each of us, lost and groping, begins to perceive it as our present task to define the difference between God and Satan. It needs courage. Great God, grant us that. Yes, certainly can. Are there any parts that you underlined or that you really remember particularly that you'd like to mention? Because the main kernel of the book, I think we've sort of touched on, but there's so many little side things that you talked about in such a good way.
I like on page 42, love opens double gates on suffering. The pain of losing good is the measure of its goodness.
Very good. That's page 42. Really good. Love opens double gates on suffering. The pain of losing good is the measure of its goodness. Oh, that's so true.
It wasn't a thing that I underlined, but the real impression it made on me was how so many times older people, when they're doing things, I've heard so many times different nursing homes and things, but when I do this, the time goes so fast, as if that's a positive thing.
Yes.
And here it just seems like she just savors time.
Exactly, just, you know, right. Very true. And yet she's very realistic, and, you know, she says a lot of times that, you know, well, sometimes she wishes that were death that was coming. And but there isn't this feeling of having to be busy with little hobbies to kind of fill in the time. Because it's not a marking time that she's doing. She's living right up to the very end. Now that's a good point, because I think that's one of the things that bothers me about retirement programs, is that so often they are, well, now we've got to keep these people busy. They've been busy all their lives. Now they've got to be busy. And we forget that, like Dorothy Sayers talks about in the importance of work and being dedicated to good work, that to take a man or a woman from the life of meaningful occupation and fill them with a lot of little hobbies that you know, they know have no real value, and yet they're supposed to, somehow that's supposed to satisfy their deepest needs. That's a It's a real, well, it's like, who was it that, is it Tennessee Williams who says, kill time, kill yourself, it's easier, quicker?
Yeah.
In that part you read about inequality, mm-hmm. which is, I could tell that, she wasn't, throwing, modern concern out the window altogether.
No.
But, I was wondering where, what would you say about drawing a line somewhere between the inequality which is desirable
mm-hmm.
and legitimate injustice?
Mm-hmm. And non-legitimate injustice.
Well, that's, actual
mm-hmm.
injustice rather than merely beneficial inequality. Now, I couldn't help wondering what would then stop you from becoming like the characters, say, in Crime and Punishment, that do everything they can to seek suffering and to seek placing themselves among the lowest because they see that as being scripturally commanded because through suffering you will grow and so
yeah.
they confess a murder they have not committed, etc., etc., so they will have more suffering. And that can't be right either.
No, or else you get Nietzsche's approach of the Superman and that you're going to be, you've got to be bigger than life and that's you've got to be an individual and okay if the rest of them are going to be a flat mob, that's just too bad for them. And this is a problem for her, and she does talk about the third world in here, I remember, in terms of concern about them, the whole world, the third world that has had so little of exposure to the things that we take for granted. And she isn't wiping out injustice, wiping out justice, a rough justice in terms of people and their needs. But what she's concerned about is that our standards do not become a mass-minded kind of a standard. We can allow and encourage as much as possible in terms of opportunities for everybody, but that we don't make mediocrity become the standard so that nobody feels embarrassed or alarmed by the challenge. And really that's essentially a snobbish point of view. Because we, as I said before, we say that we are able to cope with it. The other people aren't, and we have to protect them from feeling embarrassed. As if they didn't have, and we don't even give them the chance of being challenged by it. So that they too can become individuals. We're so worried about keeping the standards as low as possible so nobody feels challenged, and nobody might feel embarrassed or ill at ease. And so they really... then finally you have no real standard of value. It's anything but just a kind of a mishmash. Anybody remember anything else that she said, or do you find anything else that you wanted to...
There's one part, I don't even know if this is an right thing to get out of it, but...
Just, I didn't know either, Laura. There are a lot of them that I read the sentence and I think, what is that? Now, is that what it means? No, it isn't what it means. So, it's perfectly right. What page is it on?
126 and 27. She talks about, today I must suffer. Today I must be better, for I suffer, and it gives me energy. And then on 127 she says, I wonder why pain brings energy. And that reminded me a lot of, energy sounds, to me, is like a lot like passion.
Mm-hmm, it is. It is.
The things sometimes I feel like I'm just too lazy to think today, and mm-hmm. I don't have enough energy to talk to people. And it, I don't know how to say it. The idea that pain brings energy, and that, if we're living as healthy-minded people and we never look at the reality of life, we never see ourselves, we never see life as it is, we have no pain, we have no suffering, there's no passion there either.
Right. I'm so glad you mentioned this, because I had it turned on, I forgot about it. That's really, that's very important. And it's all, it also links in with what we were talking about, this inequality, that the pain and the difference, the feeling of being, you know, involved in something that makes you consciously, violently uncomfortable, has an energizing effect in terms of somehow producing something in us. She goes on and talks about this fractured femur that she had, her leg was broken, and she said, I was, on the next page, 128, I knew I was stronger than I had been before the accident. And she just now had an operation in her 80s now, and she said, the same thing happened with the major operation, and now with the pain of parting, I am more alive, and I protest that no form of expression accompanies this energy. This love and pain and energy that are so strong, while I am so weak. What do I do with them? You know? It's almost as if they were disembodied things that were floating around in her. And yet it's a way of speaking that I could bear them better if I could play an organ and let everything in me roll and rumble out the great volume of sound. No, that wouldn't help. I need to be the organ and compose out of my own being. I feel people moving like patterns. I cannot decipher. And I ask all those who, like me, seem to do nothing. Does the passion in our hearts somehow serve? You know, back there I told you that what she says about this vivid life that can't be used. You know, you feel really you're on a shelf. And when you get old, you just don't have the input anymore. And yet, I feel, and what I mentioned yesterday in the importance of not losing the quality of beingness, that there is a quality that is not always communicated necessarily verbally to other people, but the quality of your life inside of it, its confines, physically and mentally, in every direction, the quality of that life is important. It has something to do with everybody else, even if we don't see where it has something to do with it. And that's what she's asking the question. Does the passion in our heart somehow serve? Does it have a meaning? And she talks here in the previous part of this page, 129, where she's talking about order. And I think this has to do with this whole idea of roles again, that there are some things that we may not want them. We may not feel that they have a legitimate claim on us. And yet, if we don't pay attention to the order, we are going to find a real crack-up. She says here on the top of page 129, daily, hourly, we must keep the crystal clear that the colors may assume their order. I pray to fulfill my task. Don't elude me now for my soul's sake. I must live so that clarity produces the order of diversity. Nothing less than bearing it all will do. For it is the creation of a change of consciousness. Nothing less and no words are needed. It is the mystery that is done to us, as though love and pain and emergence are all intensified energy by which one is fired, ordered, and perhaps annealed. The purpose of life may be to clarify our essence, and everything else is the rich, dull, hard, absorbing chaos that allows the central transmutation. It is unstable, divine, and enough. Some days I make my possessions appear at their best, as they are my only companions. Order, cleanliness, seemliness make a structure that is half support, half ritual, and it does not create, it maintains decency. I can Some days it's the only improvement I can bring about. I remember a beautiful girl of 17 with destructive parents. Unable to improve her position in any way, she burst out with the surprising phrase, "I could meet in the stars." I don't know if you catch the reference, but remember yesterday when she talks about these women that pour out these cascades of emotion and really devour their families with their aggression, and this girl obviously had destructive parents who felt that she was never really doing enough. And so finally she said, "I could meet in the stars." And Flora Scott Maxwell says, "With less need, I meet in my flat." A garden, a cat, a wood fire, a country, to walk in woods and fields, even to look at them. But these would take strength I have not got, or a man whom also I have not got. So here in a flat, I must make the round of the day pleasant. Getting up, going to bed, meals, letters with my breakfast tray. Can I make it total to a quiet heart? I have to be a miracle of quiet to make the flame in my heart burn low. And on some good days, I am a miracle of quiet. But I cannot conceive how age and tranquility came to be synonymous. I think it's your grandmother's like this.
Probably write the same thing.
You better send it to her.
I think I will.
Tranquil, the old tranquil, I'm leaden with foreboding, not for myself, for humankind, which isn't in my care. You see, this is the frustration she has, is this passionate concern for society and people, and really, you know, in a real way, they don't consider that she's supposed to be responsible for them. She said, "Yesterday I finished my fourth book on the inevitability of a planned world. No mention was made of the high caliber of the people who would be required to create world order, and nothing less was expected, nor was the temptation to tyranny dealt with. Today I recall the difficulty always experienced in making people do what it is thought they ought to do, even with the most severe methods tried, and my hopes rose a little. I thought of great plans failing everywhere, of mighty America ineffectually trying to impose her will, of the plight of England, and I now felt more able to face the frightening fertility of man's mind. His abstract ideas, extreme, inhuman, and from which we are only saved by the incalculable turns of life itself. What a boon disparity is. Difference of opinion has never been sufficiently appreciated. It is the unexpected, the unknowable, the divine irrationality of life that saves us."